We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Herbie, let's go.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Previously on The Lawrence Holmes Show.
The virus has gone through his system. This guy's 27 years old. What they found out is that when they had him go out there and pitch again, he threw 20 pitches and then said he felt like he was 100 years old after that. He now has developed myocarditis, inflammation inside his heart. It's a common thing. It's a disease that people live with. But it is something that ended up happening to him as a side effect of having coronavirus. Look, people want to make this binary. Like either you don't get COVID and you live, or you get COVID and you die. It makes me terribly sad for this young man who wanted to play, and he is 27 years old. So the idea of a healthy athlete will be totally fine, I think is a very callous and simplistic way to look at this. Just keep his name in mind, Eduardo Rodriguez.
Make me a bicycle clown!
And then we got the news a day ago that Eduardo Rodriguez is out for the rest of the season after his post-COVID-19 heart issue. That's a very, very sad story. Welcome in. My name is Lawrence Holmes. I'm here with you until 2 o'clock. We got a lot that we got to do today. We'll talk about the Illini. We'll talk about what's going on the north side with the Red Hot Cubs. And we'll talk about what's going on with the White Sox. In fact, let's do that right now. Steve Stone is the White Sox color analyst. He's also the Score baseball expert. And he joins me now here on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford has 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from in Melrose Park or at alpamonteford.com. Stoney, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you taking a break from Twitter to come and hang out on the show.
Yeah, it's been a lively couple of days. It's actually been a whole lot of fun. And, you know, Twitter at its best is really entertaining. It's informative. And, you know, at times there are some folks who want to be argumentative or be negative. And, you know, Lawrence, the world is filled with negativity. We don't need any more. So I figure it's best to move on, and that's usually what I do.
Well, I appreciate you being available for me today, and throughout the baseball season, we'll have Stoney kind of pop in and out as one of the people on our show. I wanted to ask you about this particular player first so that I didn't forget as we get entrenched into some baseball conversation. I want to know what you think about Aaron Bummer and why he's so difficult to hit with that slider.
Well, it's not only the slider, Lawrence. It's one of the best sinkers in all of baseball. And the fact that he throws at 96 or 97 makes it that much more difficult. He is, because he's a relatively new pitcher, because he didn't start off ablaze, I think he doesn't get near the credit he deserves. I think last year he was one of the best left-handers in all of baseball that you didn't know anything about unless you were a Sox fan, and then you saw his transformation. Let me explain to you what happens with a sinker and why it's so difficult to hit. There's not a lot of guys in this day and age of baseball that throw sinkers. If they do, they throw them 90 miles an hour, 89, 91, somewhere in that range. Aaron throws his 96, 97. The reason the sinker is so valuable and so tough to hit, especially at the higher velocities, is that a hitter has a mind almost like a computer. He sees a pitch coming out of a release point. His eyes and his mind tell him that it's a fastball. They program where the hands have to get to hit the ball out front and how quickly the hands have to get there. So when you see a certain velocity, hitters can adjust to any velocity. I saw Paul Konerko turn on a Joel Zumaya 102-mile-an-hour high fastball, hit it out of the park in Detroit. Any velocity can be adjusted to. The problem hitting a sinker is that your eyes adjust. You know how fast your hands have to get out there. But when you go to hit the ball, you're not hitting the middle of the baseball. You are hitting the top of the baseball. Consequently, the ball goes straight down into the ground. Even with the higher exit velocities, it's very difficult for those balls to get out of the infield. So you throw ground ball after ground ball. You don't give up home runs. Then you add that devastating slider to go with it. And when Aaron gets ahead of hitters, it's pretty much a man versus the boys. They just don't hit him very well. So I think he's, at this point, not a secret to the guys that he's facing, but a secret to the baseball world that I think will be have more light shed on his abilities as we move along.
I know that you've been talking about on the broadcast, like even in a 60-game season, that there has to be a level of patience. That being said, how big was the last game in Cleveland for this White Sox team?
The ball club is 5-4. They're over 500. It's 9 games into the season. And, you know, look, it's a short year, but there are a couple of critical points in the course of the season. And one critical point is for a young team really struggling to all of a sudden win a game that they really have to win and play a tough and tight ball game and come out on top. And that's exactly what happened in the final game in Cleveland. You lose a doubleheader. By the way, probably the last doubleheader played this year of 9-inning duration in both games, at least 9 innings. And now they've gone to 7, as you know, to make sure things get over a little more quickly and save the pitching staffs. But that was a key game. I think when the autopsy on this season is written and people digest what happens, assuming that the Sox do get to the playoffs, and I'm thinking that they probably will, I think they'll look back at that game and say that is one of the critical games of the season. Now, you know, anytime it's that quick into the season, you can't say it's essential. But I think it was really big for the psyche of the ball club. You know, this is a team that has come from different places. Yes, Moncada's been here for a couple of years. Anderson has been here. Aliuri's been here, certainly. But Madrigal has come in. Encarnacion has come in. Grandal has come in. You know, Mazzara has come in. He's yet to play, but maybe tonight. I haven't seen the lineup yet. Keuchel has come in from someplace else. So this is a team coming together from a lot of different places, some winning backgrounds, some not. And they have to learn how to win together. And part of the maturation of a baseball team is coming together, winning some tough games, coming out on top as a club, and having the ball club start to believe in itself. It's one thing to have confidence. It's another thing to get it done in key situations, and the confidence just builds. Sox are in the building process right now. This is still, and fans don't want to hear this, but, you know, it's like telling them that the sun is rising in the east. This is still the fourth year of a five-year rebuild. This team is a pretty good, entertaining team right now, but it's not as good as it's going to be next year, and probably not as good as it's going to be the year after that. So right now, the team has talent. The young talent is starting to step up. And because they're an offensive bunch, and I think, number one, that I'm infinitely qualified to comment on the Southside Hitmen of 1977 because I was a pitcher on that ball club. This is a better hitting team across the board than the Southside Hitmen. Now, that team didn't get shut out till the first week in September by Nolan Ryan in Anaheim. This team will most likely get shut out before the equivalent to that in a short season. However, this team has much more thunder across the board, much more speed, is actually much better defensively. As far as the pitching is concerned, still a work in progress, but I love the way the back end has come together the last two games. And, of course, Giolito and Keuchel are really good at 1-2.
What did Cease do between his last start and his start yesterday to make that improvement?
I'm not sure that he did anything. I think that he just remembered the best pitch in baseball, regardless of what pitch you throw, is strike one. You throw strike one, and it sets up everything else you do. You throw ball one, it becomes an offensive at-bat. If a hitter can zone hit you, if he can look for a certain spot, regardless of what pitch you throw in that spot, you're going to have some problems. You can look at your ERA, and it's commensurate with how many 2-0, 3-1 pitches you make. You can tell a quality pitcher by the guys that consistently stay ahead, and Dylan knew that he couldn't spot his fastball the first time out. He never got ahead of hitters, and he did everything right against Kansas City. Look, Kansas City is not going to be confused with the Los Angeles Dodgers. However, that's a team that the Sox have had trouble beating in Kansas City for quite some time, and not when Kansas City was loaded. I'm talking about any Kansas City team. So it's real easy to say, oh, you know, it was Kansas City. Well, they were 3-4 when the Sox went into Kansas City. They swept them there for the first time in 5 years. So that was something the Sox have to do. Look, you beat the teams you're supposed to beat. You can't beat them all the time. But if you do that, if you battle the teams that are really tough, then things will work out fine. So bear in mind that the Sox, if this season ended right now, which I'm certainly hoping it does not, the Sox would be in the playoffs. They are in second place in the Central. They're behind Minnesota, who's an elite team. Sox are not an elite team, but they're growing as a team, which is really important.
It doesn't seem to matter if you bat Luis Robert seventh, sixth, or first. He seems to be unaffected. Why is he unaffected, considering that he's just now playing Major League Baseball?
You know, I was on with Dan and Danny last week, and what I said about spotting the batting order was, Luis Robert is a kid who doesn't really care what city he's in, who he's facing, where he hits, when he hits, as long as he hits. Lawrence, there's something called the arrogance of performance. And I get a little tired of hearing people say, well, he's arrogant or he's arrogant. If you're a performer in whatever it is in your life where you're performing, you have to have the arrogance to perform. You have to believe that in any confrontation, you're better than the guy you're performing against. If you don't believe that, you're not going to be successful. And Luis Robert believes he can hit anybody on the planet. He doesn't care if he faces him in the schoolyard. He doesn't care if he faces him in low A ball or if he faces him in the major leagues. He doesn't care if it's Verlander. He doesn't care if it's any of the great pitchers. He just goes up. He knows they have to throw the baseball somewhere within 17 inches, somewhere between the letters and the knees. They have to throw him a fastball or a curveball or a change or a slider. And when they do and they make a mistake, he's going to hit it. Oh, and by the way, he's also going to hit some pretty good pitches too. So the fact that he's very young doesn't diminish his confidence. He came up with that arrogance to perform, and I think you're going to see something special. I mean, I knew he had special talent. Now we'll see if he can continue to do that because the league is going to make adjustments to him. One of the adjustments they've already made is when they throw him a fastball, they're trying to keep it in on his hands. He's going to be able to deal with that because he's got very fast hands. He has a relatively short stroke, although it might get a little shorter, but the talent is unquestionable.
Yeah, it really is. He's so fun to watch at the plate, and he just looks confident is a great, great word for him, Stoney. Over the last couple of days, I've enjoyed Yasmani Grandal's at-bats. And I know that whenever we talk about baseball overall, that the idea of the professional at-bat comes into play. When you think of someone having a professional at-bat, what does it look like?
It's very simple, and you know, very simple because those of us who have been around the game a long time can pick up little things that happen. And I said to Jason in a broadcast a few days ago that Grandal is going to start hitting because I saw something in the last at-bat which showed me that he's starting to get on the ball. And so what happens is if you want to characterize a professional at-bat, you don't hit a pitcher's pitch before you have to. That's the mistake of the guys who are really good contact hitters or young hitters who get anxious. They're afraid to fall behind strike one. They will swing at a pitcher's pitch and not work the count to get in a situation that allows the pitcher to make a mistake. The more pitchers' pitches you swing at, the lower your batting average. The more times you go up and don't wait for your pitch, the more times you're not going to drive in the big runs. Yasmani is a quality major league hitter. He started out slowly, but he's got the back of the baseball card to show you that he is a quality major league hitter. Then you look for some of the keys in it at bat. How does he take a pitch? The average fan doesn't understand that taking a pitch well is a precursor to starting to hit the baseball. And he started to take pitches well. He started not to swing at pitcher's pitches. He started to wait, and he's very patient. He draws a lot of walks, and he waits to get the pitch, maybe the one pitch in the at-bat that he can handle. Then he handles it. That's what's happening lately. And unfortunately, Edwin Encarnacion is not doing that quite yet. But again, he's got the back of the baseball card, and hopefully he comes through. And, you know, pretty soon we're going to see Nomar Mazara. When we do see him, this lineup is going to be as it was envisioned when Rick Hahn started making all of his deals, and along with Kenny Williams, they started putting this team together.
I saw something over the weekend, a couple people touched on it. Tim Kirkchin had talked about it. JD actually brought it up in the Cubs game yesterday, and I wanted to get your opinion on this. With the new rule about extra innings and the runner on second, I've seen so many teams so far like completely forget their fundamentals of base running because they have a runner on second with nobody out. Is that a byproduct of there not really being a long ramp up to the season and people are just kind of forgetting, or is there something else at play here that's not allowing players to do things that we've seen them do, like simple stuff like ball hits the left side, freeze. You know, you're not going to beat the shortstop's throw to third base in a situation like that, and you're giving up a runner in scoring position.
Well, I don't think it's a product of a short season. I think it's a product of the era of baseball that we're in. You know, to be a really good team, you're going to have to win the games where you don't pound people. You're going to have to win the games where you don't completely shut down the other team's offense. You're going to have to win some games with finesse. You're going to have to win some games with smarts. And that goes hand in hand with understanding base running. Base running truly is a lost art. With the idea that we're not stealing many more bases because the sabermetricians have said, and justifiably so, by the way, that getting thrown out on a stolen base attempt or bunting and giving up an out is not the best way to win games. Well, in doing that, the one thing that we can't lose is that part of winning close games, part of execution both offensively and defensively, is understanding how to run the bases. You don't have to be fast to run the bases well. You don't have to be a particularly smart team to have good base running ability. It has to be taught. How do you push off a base and go to the next base? What's the best way to do that? Which foot do you want to hit the base? How do you want to hit the first base bag? You want to hit it in front of the bag. You don't want to hit the top of the bag or the back of the bag because you're probably going to be out in a situation where you're going to be safe. When do you go to the back of the bag to avoid a tag? Which side do you want to slide on? I mean, does your hitter know that if he's going to score and there's a runner behind him, he becomes another coach at the plate and he gives signs as to where to slide? There is an art to the game. It's a very nuanced game, Lawrence. It's a game that at its highest levels is a brilliantly composed ballet where nine guys play as one. You don't see it often, but when you do, it's beautiful. And the better teams are able to do that. Sure, this White Sox team can pound some people. 35 hits the last 2 days. They got guys up and down this lineup that can really hurt you. But they're going to play a lot of games where it's tough and it's tight late. The best organization I ever was at was Baltimore. And the reason is we felt as a group, and it happened before I got there. I mean, I had nothing to do with making this philosophy. But we knew that we were going to win that night because we were going to hold that other team close. And when it came time to make a mistake, that other team was going to make it. And when they did, we were going to bury them with that one mistake. And that's what good teams feel like. good teams feel that they're going to out-execute the other team both offensively and defensively. And when they do, they're going to win the close games. You don't find many good teams that can't win a 2-1, 3-2, 4-3 game. Those teams don't exist, and usually if they do exist, they're going home and watching the playoffs. So the Sox have a lot of room for growth. There's aspects of the game they don't do particularly well, but they're not supposed to. This isn't the finished product. It will be in the not-too-distant future, but right now we have to enjoy the ride because the ride, by and large, is offensive. Offense creates excitement. Excitement creates a fan base that is gravitating towards this team. This is a good time to be a White Sox fan.
One more thing before I let you go, Stoney, and Steve Stone joins us occasionally. We talk baseball, and we love when Stoney's on the show. I think that Nick Madrigal is a really interesting player. And I know that people are super high on him. My concern is he going to be able to hit with enough velocity off his bat? He makes contact. There's no doubt about that. But is that contact going to be weak contact? Now, he had a great game yesterday, and he's placing it where they ain't. Hit it where they ain't. What's fair to expect or believe about the type of player and hitter Nick Madrigal can be for the White Sox?
Well, Lawrence, I'm going to put your mind at ease.
Okay.
One of the outs that he made in the game before he got the four hits was 112 miles an hour. Off the bat, exit velocity. When you hit the ball 112 miles an hour, the expectancy on a base hit is over 70%. You, on balls hit over 112 miles an hour, a hitter would hit over 700. Nick Madrigal is going to get stronger, not going to get any bigger. He won't get any faster. He's fast enough now. But the point is, two object lessons in baseball staring Nick Madrigal in the face. One is Dustin Pedroia, MVP with the Red Sox. The other is Jose Altuve, MVP with Houston. They're both smaller than Madrigal. So Nick has everything he needs to be an excellent baseball player. Defensively, he's wonderful. Base running, he's got it down. Every aspect of the game he knows, a baseball acumen off the charts. And here's the thing about when you look at the front office of the White Sox, you look at Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams, you have to foresee what your lineup is going to look like in a year or two if you're building. A manager has immediate sight, short-term sight, and a front office has to have a short-term combined with a long-term sight. So when you draft Madrigal with the fourth pick in the country, first round, fourth pick in the country out of a great program at Oregon State, you are looking how he fits into the lineup that you're going to have down the road. They knew that they had a lot of strikeouts. This is a prolific strikeout team. I mean, it's penthouse or outhouse. You're going to hit the ball hard. You can hit it out of the park. You're going to strike out a lot. So they knew that bringing Madrigal in does a couple of things. One, they knew that he was a smart player. So the team gets a little bit smarter if he's in your lineup. They also knew that he can make contact. He's going to put the ball in play. So in the ninth spot, he becomes another table setter to go with Tim Anderson if he's leading off. You got two table setters ahead of the big bangers in the middle. That's long-distance sight. That's what Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams and their front office and their scouts and everybody involved were thinking when they drafted Nick out of Oregon State. It was an inspired pick. It was a great pick. And the people who say he's too small, he doesn't hit the ball hard enough, with all due respect, Lawrence, he hits the ball hard enough most of the time, and he's a guy that's going to help you turn every double play you're supposed to turn, assuming he gets the ball in a good spot. Sox are in good hands at second base for a long time.
Well, you have made me feel a little bit better about it, Stoney, and that's why I asked
Thanks, Lawrence.
Questions.
That's my job here.
Thank you so much, Stoney. Have a great call. I'm looking forward to seeing the White Sox hopefully continue the streak that they're on.
Remember one thing, Lawrence, and this is a compliment to you. Great questions make for pretty good answers, and your questions were really good today. Keep it going.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. That is Steve Stone. You can watch him on the White Sox broadcast as a color analyst alongside our friend Jason Benetti and as one of our Score baseball experts. We'll take a break. Back after this on The Score.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Roberts slices a ball to right center field. Starling back at the wall. It is gone! Easy power from 88, and it's 5-0 Sox.
You could hear it, and you could pretty much tell by the reaction of Starling in center field that that one wasn't coming back.
Happy birthday to Luis Robert. He is 23 years old, and he's so much fun to watch. Talk about confidence. Swagger at the top of the lineup while Tim Anderson is out for the White Sox. There has been another roster move for the White Sox, and I, depending on where you stand, it's both good and bad news. The good news is that Nomar Mazara is healthy enough to play. So he has been activated, and he will be called up from Schaumburg to play. The bad news is your mean Mercedes got his opportunity at the pro level, and now he's got to go to Schaumburg.
Oh, no!
But what we've learned is one can learn a lot in a week in Schaumburg. So maybe your mean will get an opportunity yet again to be on the team. He had an at-bat yesterday, but now he goes back to Schaumburg. I'm glad that he got the at-bat, but still. So Nomar Mazara, we'll see if he is in the lineup tonight for the White Sox as the White Sox get ready to take on Milwaukee. So the White Sox can help the Cubs out, and the Cubs can do a lot of damage against a team that the White Sox beat up this weekend. I suspect the same thing is going to be true of the Cubs. The Cubs have a home-and-home with Kansas City this week where they'll play two games at Wrigley versus KC, and then they'll go to KC to play the Royals. The Royals are not very good. They're not. So there should be some opportunities here for the Cubs to continue with where they're at right now. Where they're at right now is 7-2 and winning games. They've won three in a row. They swept yesterday of the Pirates, who are also not very good. But you have to win those games. I was talking about this on Loho Daily yesterday. Whether you're the Cubs or the White Sox, you have to make teams like this pay. Like, they're going to get the brunt of the good team's ire. So Pittsburgh and Kansas City and Detroit, if you're the Cubs or the White Sox and you're looking to pad your resume, you got to take care of business when these teams are put in front of you. You can't lose series to these teams that are put in front of you. So we'll see what the Cubs do over the next four games, but I suspect they'll win three out of four, maybe four out of four. Yesterday, the game went into extras, and we saw some terrible base running and Joey Cora making a terrible call to send a runner. What I ask this question all the time, and I'll ask it again. Why do people run on Kyle Schwarber? If we found out nothing else about him as a defender, what you should know is that he's got a strong and accurate arm from the outfield. What are you doing, Joey Cora? What are you doing? The Pirates were plagued with terrible base running all day yesterday, and especially at the end of the game. It's one of the reasons why I was talking to Stoney about that. And when that happens, you have to make them pay. And yesterday in the 11th, Javier Baez made them pay.
Baez hits a base hit up the middle. The Cubs win it. A sharp single, a line drive right back through the box. The Cubs win it by a score of 2-1 in 11 innings. David Bote comes in to score. Javier Baez drives in the run. And in 11 innings, the Cubs prevail by a score of 2-1, and the Cubs are celebrating, high fives, not too many bear hugs.
socially distant celebration yesterday. It was kind of funny and good. John Lester was really good after he settled in yesterday. David Ross will join us tomorrow at noon, and we will talk with Rossi about that. I do have something funny from last week, though, that we'll get to a little bit later on. We need to take a timeout. When we come back, are the Illini the team to beat in the Big East? Big East. Big Ten? And Big East. But Big Ten this year? Are they the team to beat basketball-wise? Because they got two potential NBA players back. And Jeremy Warner is going to help me talk about what this means and why those guys are returning. We'll do that next here on The Score.
This is 670 The Score. We're your home for live, local Chicago sports. Homegrown Chicago guys talking about all of Chicago's teams. We are live and local. Sports Radio 670 The Score. Chicago's number one sports station. Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Osubu to the elbow, contested. That's good. He is so special. What a jumper by Ayo Dosunmu. Two-possession game in Champaign with 31 seconds to play.
Listening to this show, you probably are like, oh, Herbie forced an Illini guest onto the show because he's Mr. Illini. And I actually, that is incorrect. I'm the one who was like, we should probably talk Illinois basketball because this is unprecedented. I don't know if I want to use that word, but I'm definitely surprised at the fact that you had Ayo and Kofi come back to Champaign. So I want to talk with my buddy Jeremy Warner about that. He is the publisher of the Illini Inquirer. He can also check him out on the Illini Inquirer podcast. So I was listening to him and Mr. Piper talk about all of these things. And you can also find him on 24/7 Sports and CBS Interactive. He joins me now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford has 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from in Melrose Park, or if you go to alpamonteford.com. Jeremy, how are you, man?
Doing well, Lawrence. How rightfully obnoxious is Herbie right now about his Illini?
He's been actually very subdued so far about Illinois and their basketball chances. But I would say that you're correct, that he could rightfully be puffing out his chest because of what happened. So let's take each guy individually. Why did Ayo come back?
The pandemic, simply. He did not plan on coming back. He did really not want to come back. He planned on all along, and he deserved, after the season he had, to go test his ability in the open market in the NBA and go to the NBA Draft Combine in his home city of Chicago and show off there and kill it in some of the in-person interviews, because he's that kind of person who had done really well there. When he gets competition, he only ups his game. So I think if he would have had a normal process, and he basically told us this yesterday, if there was no pandemic, he probably would have been gone. But the pandemic left so much uncertainty that a borderline guy like Ayo, even though I would have invested a second-round pick in him, even though I think a team might have invested a second-round pick in him, there was just too much uncertainty. He wasn't able to go through a normal draft process that he said, okay, instead of maybe, you know, rolling the dice and leaving this to chance, I can come back to Illinois, be an All-American, lead Illinois to a deep run in the NCAA tournament, maybe a first-place finish in a Big Ten championship, their first in 16 years. If I do that, maybe I can be a first-round pick. So instead of having a two-way contract or a G League contract, and I have to rise my way up, maybe I can get a better start to my NBA career by coming back, maybe solidifying myself a guaranteed contract, whether that's late first round or early second round, and making myself a legend at Illinois, because he's going to be – one of the most talked about college basketball players now. He's going to have this huge spotlight. And as we know, when you make a run in the NCAA tournament, the NBA pays more attention then, and they put a lot of stock into what you do with the brightest spotlight on you. So I think I would assume we just weighed his options and just said, that's the safer option. That's the better entry point for me into my NBA career.
Okay, so why would Kofi come back?
He needed to. You know, there was some talk that maybe he could go pro. And listen, somebody would have paid him a lot of money to play basketball. He's 7 foot, 285 pounds, just a physical force. But when we talk about the NBA level, the NBA doesn't have a lot of guys like Kofi Coburn. He's more the old school, big shot blocker, dunks everything within 5 feet. But he hasn't shown a lot of a mid-range game, hasn't shown a lot of a face-up game. Defensively, while he's great around the rim, he's very vulnerable when it comes to hedging ball screens, things like that. So he's improved all that stuff. He improved himself so much in just the year he'd been here, but he probably wasn't going to get drafted. If he comes back to Illinois, I think the biggest thing is Illinois is so invested in him that the strength and conditioning coach, Adam Fletcher, that Orlando Antigua, the big man's coach, Brad Underwood, they're also invested in him being successful, that he might not get that if he's a G League player, if he goes overseas, where they're not afraid to just cut you and take the next guy. I think he can grow his game the most at Illinois, and I think he can, you know, improve his game and have the best showcase for him in college. So we thought all along he would come back and be one of the best Big Ten players, but now that Iowa's along with him, those two make up, I think, the best duo in the Big Ten of players and one of the best duos in the country.
I was listening to you on the Illini Inquirer podcast, and you were about as bullish as I think I've ever heard you on the Illini's chances in the Big Ten. Why?
Because they're a well-rounded team. As I said, those two stars, they're two of the best five players in the Big Ten, in my opinion. DeSumo is the best returning guard, while Kofi Coburn isn't as good as Luka Garza. And Iowa is certainly going to be a handful with Garza, with Bohannon coming back from injury. And, you know, they have some really good offensive players. I think Illinois is deeper. They add two top 50 guards that are freshmen in this class. Andre Curbelo, who's some comp to Cassius Winston. Adam Miller, another Chicago Morgan Park kid, originally from Peoria, who can really help them shooting-wise. That's a big weakness of their team. Adam Miller is one of the best shooters that's coming in as a true freshman. They have some veterans in Trent Frazier, who just a couple years ago was the face of the franchise here, but he's one of the best defenders in the Big Ten. Georgie Bishanishvili is a backup post who really could start for a lot of teams in the post, but he's going to back up Kofi Coburn. They had two transfers they're really excited about who sat out last year, who had a lot of maturity and shooting to the team. Austin Hutcherson, Jacob Grandison. Demonte Williams out of Peoria is one of the best defenders, a glue guy on this team. And then they just have more depth after that. Coleman Hawkins, a freshman they're excited about. Benjamin Bossman's Verdonk, an overseas kid. So it's that depth plus a balance. They're a really good offensive team, and they would have been probably a pretty good offensive team regardless of whether these guys came back, but obviously this takes them to another level. But Iowa, my only issue with Iowa is they're the worst, one of the worst defensive teams in the Big Ten. Fran McCaffrey hasn't had great defensive teams there. Illinois, I think, has four guys who really are really good defenders. Demonte Williams, Trent Frazier, Io DeSumo can be really good with his length, and then Kofi Coburn around the rim. So I just think that balance makes them more consistent. I know people in Wisconsin, people in Michigan State certainly have a case. But I think for the first time in since D. Brown wore an Illini uniform, that Illinois enters the season as a legit Big Ten title contender, and probably for the first time in 16 years, my opinion, they enter as the Big Ten favorite, though some would disagree.
Jeremy Warner is a very talented writer and broadcaster. You can check him out, Illini Inquirer. I know that you talk to people around college football all the time. What are they telling you about whether or not college football can work?
Yeah, we're waiting to hear from Kevin Warren. That's the biggest one. I mean, everyone else seems to be ready to go. The Big Ten was the first conference, and Kevin Warren, the new commissioner, in his first year, boy, what a first year for Kevin Warren on the job. But he was the first one to cut out non-conference play, basically so he could have more flexibility with the schedule, have kind of the same testing throughout this. But unlike these other schools, they haven't announced the schedule yet. He told schools not to start training camp this week. Illinois was all ready to go, but they kind of had to hold off. They're hoping to hear either today or tomorrow about when camp can start, when the season can start. Listen, I think they can pull it off if these were just football players, right? If they were just in a bubble. I think you're seeing that, you know, baseball's having this issue with players just in these cities, and they're basically just together. What happens when you get 105 football players and all these staff members on a campus that's supposed to have 30,000 plus people in it. And I was 19, 20 years old. I felt invincible once. How are they going to pull this off when college students probably at some point want to be college students? So I think that's the really tough thing with college football. But I think, Lawrence, they're going to try to play. That's what I've said all along, because there's too many millions of reasons why they need to play. And that's the balance of health and safety, but also, you know, these athletic departments live off college football, you know, and Big Ten network money. And even if you can't get any fans in the stadium, that Big Ten network revenue was close to $50, $60 million for Illinois last year, which is about half of what their budget is. So just to get those games on TV. But what I think is going to happen, Lawrence, is they're going to try to play, and they'll get some games in. They'll have to postpone some games. So maybe Illinois plays 8 games, Ohio State plays 10, Michigan plays 5. I don't know, but I just think they're going to try and squeeze in as many games as they can.
Clearly, a lot of people are heartbroken by the passing of Lou Henson. What's the most interesting thing you've heard about Lou Henson over the last couple weeks?
I think the biggest thing I've taken away, and I've gotten to meet Lou, and he couldn't have been nicer to me, so I get it. I didn't get to cover him. I didn't live through most of the Lou Henson era. I wasn't sports conscious yet through that. But everyone is talking more about the man than the coach. And you think about the coach. He's got – I know Deion Thomas, my good friend, was on your show the other day. He's got 2 courts named after him. He's the leading – he's got more wins at 2 different programs than any other coach at those programs, with New Mexico State and Illinois. He led Illinois to a Final Four. He's in the Hall of Fame. But people talk more about Lou and Mary Henson, his wife, and just how they took time out of their day to talk to you, or how that they had so much integrity. And he was really, you know, the polar opposite of Bob Knight. You know, Bob Knight won all these championships, but people, you know, question his methods of how he did it. And people sometimes, you know, question the integrity of how he did that, just with how, you know, old school he was with all of that. Nobody does that with Lou Henson. And, you know, they made for good battles in the Big Ten, but it's just the person Lou Henson was. Because I can tell you, Lawrence, he changed Champaign-Urbana, not just Illinois basketball, but he made Illinois basketball what to the modern program is today. And that completely changes Champaign-Urbana, because athletics has such a huge impact on these universities, on these communities, and Lou Henson will forever be in the fabric of Champaign-Urbana.
Jeremy, as always, I appreciate your time. I also appreciate that you are moving your career like forward, and I'm really happy to see you have continued success, and the podcast is great, and everything you're doing with Illini Inquirer is great. So thanks for carving out a little bit of time for me.
Anytime, Warner. Thanks, man.
That is Jeremy Warner. You can check out Illini Inquirer. You can check him out on 247sports.com and CBS Interactive. Cubs baseball, let's talk about it. They're 7-2. Bruce Levine joins me next here on The Score.
Blackhawks win. They take game 1 over the Oilers in this epic 5-game play-in series. Keep it on The Score as we recap the win and get you ready for game 2 right here on Sports Radio 670 The Score, a radio.com sports station.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.